Hey, buttheads, welcome to our podcast, Bob Zemeckis is Not a Butthead. I'm Richard, and I'm here with my buddy Kyle. Hey, Kyle, what's up?
I'm Kyle. Yeah, here's me coming in. Yeah, Kyle Bogart also here. Episode 2, Bob Zemeckis is Not a Butthead. Richard, how are you doing? Might I say, Richard, your mustache is coming in nicely.
Yeah, I just trimmed this for you, so it would look bigger.
Almost like a real mustache. It's kind
almost
of
real.
It's Flandersing a little bit, which is, I think, appropriate for your whole existence.
You know,
I was going back and forth about whether or not we should have a video component to this podcast, but your mustache, I think, has sealed it for me. I think that we need to post this somewhere, probably Pornhub, just so that people can see that stash, especially because of that stash. That's a porn stash coming in. It's a little thin for a porn stash, but I think that that's appropriate given your
existence. If I make it thinner, it will be better. Used cars.
Used cars.
That's what we just watched. Used cars.
So this is another thing, like when we started talking about doing this, I kind of winced a little bit because I knew that I was going to have to fess up to an embarrassing blind spot, which is that I have not seen Used Cars, despite
the fact
that many friends have told me to see it over the years. And I think that in itself is kind of why we're doing this podcast, because I think more people would have told me to see this. Like, for instance, and just to get this out of the way, because it was the thing that excited me immediately, is that Beef from Phantom of the Paradise was the second lead of the film. You know, he plays the best friend. And
Of course.
And he was in Terror Vision. Yeah, Garrett
Graham,
whatever his name is. Yeah. Great, awesome, cool. And it's like, but why is it I've been to multiple Phantom of the Paradise screenings, and you know, Brian De Palma, ooh, fucking hip, you know, and no one's been like, you know, if you like Beef, where you could see a lot more Beef, he's all up in Used Cars. And that's actually a lie. Several people have told me to see Used Cars, but I hadn't made that particular connection. Anyway, so I admit to the world I have not seen Used Cars, and the first time, I literally finished watching it about 20 minutes ago, and I'm excited to talk about it.
Yeah, me too. Movie, I hadn't seen it either. My dad always would ask, he asked the same way several times in my life, did you ever see Used Cars? And I'd be like, no. And he'd be like, it's Kurt Russell selling used cars. And then he would
I have to say, that's a very good impression of your father. That is actually what he sounds like.
Yeah, it's pretty close,
like,
right?
He's kind of like an old prospector. You can imagine him like a very dusty hat, like emerging from a mine.
He wears hats now.
Good. Are they dusty from the mine?
No, he keeps them pretty clean. He hasn't reached dusty hat stage.
I guess he would be more of like a shake in a pan in a river kind of a prospector, like Tom Waits in that one Coen Brothers
Buster
movie.
Scruggs.
Just on Netflix, Buster Scruggs. That's how I see your father retiring. Searching for the last remaining gold out California.
Where are you, Mr. Pocket? what'd you think of Used Cars?
First reaction is I really dug it. I thought it was funny, but I was kind of shocked at how aggressively it defined who Robert Zemeckis was in my mind. Like, both with I Want to Hold Your Hand before this, and suddenly it was this kind of thread that now connected so much of who he was and the rest of his filmography kind of instantaneously when you watch it, aside from the obvious inclusions of, again, like Linda McFly and Jimmy Olsen, who were in the first movie and then this and then in Back to the Future. But even just like, aha, you see this guy trying to reconcile this like Blake Edwards tech savory desire to make a fucking cartoon thing. You see him trying to do that, and you see these, but it's different than Back to the Future. It's not this sanitized version of that. It is quite profane and R-rated at the same time that it's
very vulgar. It's an adult Looney Tunes. Legit adult Looney Tunes.
Yeah, I legitimately said to Cliff, I was like, weirdly, I'm thinking of Ren and Stimpy while I'm watching this, which is just a weird thought to have in mind, but it just sort of popped in there. How did you think, Richard?
I also really liked it, and I feel like you mentioned in the last one that you felt that I Want to Hold Your Hand was kind of a Rosetta Stone for Zemeckis, and I feel like this I felt
much more so.
Much more so. Yeah. You can see
it's more the it's if I Want to Hold Your Hand is the prelude or the prologue, and then here we have our big first act in the Zemeckis career, where we kind of understand, okay, this I think is his vision for cinema that he's trying to get right out there in the world, but it won't be complete for a couple more movies, I don't think. But go ahead.
Right. And there was some stories back with I Want to Hold Your Hand on some of those special features, Spielberg talking about how Zemeckis met Zemeckis, and they immediately folded in with Zemeckis, and Zemeckis, Milius, and Spielberg and Bob Gale would hang out. And one of the things that Milius used to say about Zemeckis' shorts was it was socially irresponsible, and that is like writ all over this movie.
Yes,
which I think is like, okay, this is the anarchist. Like he's just an anarchist.
Yes, and we've already decided. And at this moment, unfortunately, we have not yet watched the shorts, but we are going to now watch them as part of an episode, because this
you have
thing,
to at this point. You have to have at to. This point.
What this movie, and I experienced this with I Want to Hold Your Hand, and I think the rest of this episode we'll put a little bit more meat on the bones of this idea. But it's like suddenly with this film, especially in reference to Back to the Future and Roger Rabbit and a million other things, this film has given me a lens through which to re-examine Bob Zemeckis. So I'm kind of glad that I didn't see it until now, in the sense that you can begin to start to see the shape of where things are going in a really cool way. But so Richard, first reactions, used cars, we're getting into it. What's this film?
It is adult Looney Tunes set on a used car lot between two rival used car salesmen. That's like broad strokes, but it's this crazy mad dash. Like watching it, it felt like it was made by angry prankster boys just whispering in the back of class, like getting in trouble, being screamed at.
Yes, it very much had a mischievous boy.
It is definitely boy.
Yes, exactly.
Two boys.
Yes, exactly. No, and that's I don't know. It was interesting because first of all, just so Kurt Russell owns a used car lot with a grandfatherly like Jack Warner, and then across the street is Jack Warner's brother, also played by Jack Warden, which is fucking, which is, by the way, I think in that moment that Jack Warden was like my favorite character actor, because I got unreasonably excited when I realized that A, he was in the movie, and then B, that I was going to get a double dose of him. Like there's very few actors, I think, where if I was getting two of him, I would be that excited. Yes, exactly.
Well, it's funny. He fought for both roles. He got offered one and decided to do it because he forced them to let him do the second role.
That's funny because I had explicitly this thought, and I almost wrote it down as a note. It's like, oh, it makes perfect sense, because like, who would you want to play the grandfatherly, you know, mentor who dies, you know? And it's like, well, the best guy, Jack Warden, obviously. And I was like, well, who would play the best guy to play like this tough, smarmy, whatever, the villain guy? It's like, well, clearly Jack Warden. It's like, well, they're brothers. Boom, double dose. And the rest of the cast is insane in this movie. You just have Kurt Russell and others. But anyway, just lots of familiar faces from both. And it's like, and a lot of faces
Michael
from
McKean?
Television.
Michael McKean shows up, yeah.
Well, yes, exactly. But you have Lenny and Squiggy from Laverne and Shirley, and you have Grandpa Munster showing up as the judge, and like weird people from Shirley. And those are the people that from my, you know, born in 1985 eyes recognize. I'm sure the film is populated with quite a few other recognizable faces from TV and everything. But geez, it was a lot of people.
Yeah, and just a few interesting things about like the cast. Jack Warden, again. I don't think he'd ever been in a rated R movie, he couldn't swear. He hadn't been allowed to swear on screen.
Oh.
So you get the beautiful line, asshole my dick, which is such a stupid, wonderful line to say. And Kurt Russell is just coming out of like the Disney thing.
Yes.
He'd been Disney boy for forever. And even like a couple years before was in like his face slapped on a Disney VHS tape. Yes. So this
which
is
makes
kinda...
it all the more which makes it all the more rad that he's starring in this sort of weird, perverse cartoon of a movie and stuff. And just that core group is so great, you know, because it's Kurt Russell. You got Beef. You got Lenny and Squiggy. Michael McKean is sexy in this movie too.
I know.
Like a sexy energy. Like, doesn't like he could ham it up, but I think he's like, I've spent too much time being a goof on TV or whatever, and he's like, I'm gonna like let people know that I can lay pipe just with my the energy I'm gonna convey. And he's like long hair, and he's
and the bandana. And
yeah, like especially yeah. Even the way he says rechargeable, like yeah, when
rechargeable
like with the ridiculous pacemaker that is in.
Oh my god, I love that!
I mean, it's to talk about so the cartoon logic of this film, when Lenny and Liz install or Lenny and Squiggy have the build like are geniuses technology people, and they've installed a pacemaker in his chest, and they're like, "How do you change the batteries in that thing?" He goes, "It's rechargeable," and he plays it in such a weird, grounded, like sexy way. You're just like, that's a weird way to have chosen to go that, but I dig it, and I'm into it, man. He had to throw out some sexy energy.
And I love that gag. It's like, there's no reason for that gag. It's just in there. It's like, they know. Well, they're super technical. Here's the pacemaker.
But I will say is like the inclusion, the escalation of that kind of bizarre logic, that cartoon logic in the film is slowly building a world out. Like the kind of cool, it's a throwaway gag, yeah, but the cool thing that he's doing is he's building out a world where he can set up a scenario where like the judge has to measure a mile of cars so all the 16-year-old kids are get like if the world feels too grounded by the time you make it there and you haven't right. had the pacemaker moments, then people are like, this whole situation seems preposterous. No one would sue over saying a mile of cars or whatever the fucking thing is. And he's like just letting you know, like, this is the great race, this is Blake Edwards, this is cartoons, this is
it kind of has to reset at that point because had started to the movie had gotten gets there's that second hack, the commercial hack that they do right before that, which is funny, but also like it's not really Looney Tunes. It's just super dark where they're cutting into the president's address and they're using live ammunition to blow out windshields and cars.
Which was the most rad scene I have ever seen in my life. I mean, I know you were going to be like, guess your favorite part of the movie or whatever, but come on, we both know. It's like, we're blowing the holy fucking shit out of prices. And he fucking shoots thing. I wish I had the quote with me because I just saw the movie for the first time ending 20 minutes ago. And it's like, that was a moment where I literally just like laughed out loud, sat up, and I was just like, Beef is a cowboy and he's shooting cars. And then right when it couldn't have been escalated anymore, then the other member of the group we haven't mentioned yet, the chief from Last Action Hero, shows up as high prices on top of a car.
As Grimace from the McDonald's commercials.
And he shoots him with a bloody squib in the chest and he dies horribly falling down. You know, I mean, it's a gag in the movie, but still, it's just bonkers. You know, it's bonkers how much energy he is demanding of everyone and putting on the screen. You kind of get it. It's a rad movie. Richard, tell me more about used cars.
I was going to guess your favorite part was going to be the first commercial one. The first commercial.
Oh, yes.
which that was my guess just because that is it's like we talked about lines being crossed and I want to hold your hand. And that's certainly one of them in this movie you're like, you think you know what movie you're watching and then that happens. And then the second commercial is also one, but like just the hood flies up and her tits are all out and
and then the camera just moving in an angry sustained amount of time all that. But here's the thing is that I think that some people would come into this movie and think that like, well, there's a lot of just weird, you know, it's like, well, it's a cartoon but it's also incredibly vulgar, or maybe there's like tonal mismatches where there's like a cartoon but this old man is being tossed around inside of a car and it's actually kind of terrifying and reminiscent of Death Proof, also starring Kurt Russell, which is something we can talk about. But what's interesting is how Kurt Russell, and I guess we have to kind of start getting into the story a little bit if we want to talk about that, how that animalistic boy, mischievous boy energy is kind of contextualized within the film, which is interesting because it exists in this world where it's at odds not just with love or responsibility or needing to get a job, you know, this boyish whatever it is, like in a film like Knocked Up, which opens with a similar kind of just crazy exuberant, like a you know, bacchanal of fucking, you know, whatever. It's not that. It's at odds with a kind of with a literal magic that exists in the world. Like an actual kind of magic, which we are again starting to kind of see materialize as a recurring theme in Bob Zemeckis' movies, of fate and love and a bunch and red cars and curses and all sorts of other really interesting things, as represented by our two leads. Because of course, Kurt Russell, to begin where we must begin with him, he is like totally a man of this world. He is we are introduced to him in an amazing shot that pushes in onto a dashboard.
The odometer.
He is literally winding back the odometer. So he's like the perfect, he is like the ultimate pragmatist. He is the ultimate kind of materialist. He's the ultimate kind of, he doesn't believe in magic or any of that hooey or any of that.
Just gotta do anything. Gotta do anything and to rip whomever off to get the money to get into the Senate.
Exactly. He's trying to enrich himself. He's spiritually bankrupt, etc. And that's where we begin. Now, at the same time, though, you know, rather than just portraying that he is in like this slight, like that he's in hell or whatever thing, it's like it allows us to kind of enjoy that sensibility for a while, or at least the chaos of that sensibility for a while, in the sense that we get to enjoy his many antics selling cars. Richard, do you want to tell us about how we're introduced to Kurt Russell and his many antics selling cars? Because and shenanigans and goings on.
Yeah, you have that shot with him winding back the odometer, which is of course the big sweeping jib shot that goes from big wide shot to hyper close up on the odometer. Mm-hmm. He bangs his head on the dashboard when he gets up. His bumpers are flying off when he closes his doors, and he's sticking gum up. He's ripping open a new car smell package, which is totally cartoon, spraying it everywhere. He's slapping bumper stickers on cars as they leave the lot. He uses a fishing line. He uses a fishing line with a $10 bill on it to sneak a guy from the other lot across traffic.
Exactly. About just the film announcing itself, not unlike the Pacemaker beat, announcing itself as a cartoon. Yes, it's like the cars are not just shitty used cars. They are basically trash. They are cartoon level of used cars. They are breaking down. They're falling apart. They're slapping on. They're like stealing tags and putting blue paint that's running off on the outside. They're like, so that's beautiful. The level of huckster that's going on there. And then across the street, we have Jack. So, and the other thing is that, you know, of course, Kurt Russell's mentor is Jack Warden, who we see is kind of
old grandfatherly Jack Warden with a big old mustache,
who is like on the verge of a heart attack. Literally the entire time we know him in the film, until it's just a countdown the whole time, because he's constantly
holding
his chest,
and white. They made him white.
Yes, he is like death colored from the moment we meet him. He's kind of a balance to he's taken a back seat in this place, but he's kind of a balance to Kurt Russell in the sense that he's moral, at least extent that he's like wants to sell cars cheaply to a driving school that Kurt Russell, of course, has no interest in. It's like, I could get more money, more material things.
Give him these even trashier cars, exactly. Which are sitting back here.
The camera pans over. He literally wants to give them trash. Like, yes, he wants to literally give them rusted out trash that have wheels and stuff like that. Which is interesting. And then, of course, on the other side, we see kind of Jack Warden's brother, the more advanced version of Kurt Russell's character, as Kurt Russell will come to find, who is the sort of who is also played by Jack Warden, who is a huckster who runs a very successful business. But we see that his dealings are corrupt, that he is conspiring to bring in a big freeway or something, which we learn later on anyway. But mainly it's a big reason for there to be two opposite camps sitting across the street from each other and begin to launch salvos of pranks and antics, including cutting into live streams with commercials and then anti-commercials where they cut into the president's address while blowing up cars in Jack Warden's front yard. Jack Warden has a wholesome carnival to try and gain people.
Wholesome family entertainment. And wholesome I love that moment when all the strippers come out and everybody runs across, including the families with their children, because that's what American culture is now. It's like, come on, kids. We have to go to the used car lot to watch the strippers dance on top of the top
for
of
sure.
The
I definitely Bob Zemeckis has no very little faith in the institutions of men, in the sense that like
none at all,
Kurt Russell's corrupt path, because he is such a huckster, it's not to be to own all the car lots, it's not to blah 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 blah, it's he wants to be a senator or state senator, whatever. Yeah. He has political aspirations. He literally plays "Hail to the Chief" when he comes into his place on a little recorder, and you know that makes him. You know, that makes him. We're not sure. Maybe it's all for good. Maybe it's all for not. We're not sure what being a senator means yet at this point in the movie, but we're very, very sure that it's definitely an extension of just ego for him at this point. He just wants more attention on himself, and he needs $50,000, and this whatever this is, this used car lot, is his way to get there and stuff. And then his world, his perfect world, his perfect ordered world, where he doesn't care about spiritual things, and he is just, and let's talk about that stripper sequence, by the way, the kind of the culmination of the just opening Looney Tunes bits of the movie, is he turns his car lot into a disco.
Well, I think like
girls dancing on cars.
He's revealed that he has all these ideas before the grandfather, mm-hmm. Jack Warden dies. He pitches mm-hmm. him all these ideas about how he's going to get the car lot to improve so he can make more money, mm-hmm. so he can go be a senator. Jack Warden's character just says, "I'll give you the money." And then of course does not live long enough to do that. And so
correct.
The lot then would revert to his brother across the street, which he wants to prevent at any cost.
We did bypass the main inciting incident of the film, which is that Jack Warden has a heart attack in definitely one of an insane sequence, because basically in a way that it pays. So all of Jack Warden, old grandfatherly painting to death, Jack Warden, all of his feigned heart attack, or like his being right on the edge of heart attacks for the whole movie, culminates with a strategy from brother Jack Warden, who wants to see him dead, of hiring a demolition derby driver to test drive one of his cars. And so Jack Warden gets in, and then he just death proofs him to death, not unlike Kurt Russell would later death proof Rose McGowan to death in Death Proof, by just driving him around ferociously in a car with some amazing fucking
just leaping over the median, playing chicken. There's so many good jumps just in that sequence, and then the car rolls, and then that leads to my favorite part, where we have Kurt Russell in the office trying to finish the sale for a car. $50 wouldn't kill anybody. $50 wouldn't kill anybody, says the guy across the table from him. And Kurt Russell's like, no, like, you had a handshake. And the guy's like, $50 wouldn't kill anybody. And then Kurt Russell says, I'll go ask my boss, but I guarantee you he's going to have a stroke. And then he leaves, and then Jack Warden bursts in, clutching his chest, and the guy's like, I'll sign.
That's great. Well, I love that. It's just the interesting thing is, like, he cultivates all this real empathy for Jack Warden, and then all this real palpable danger for him, and this rather menacing looking guy driving him around, and all to build towards making his death just a silly punchline to this joke, which is a funny and a delightful release of tension after all of that.
The danger,
like, man,
yeah.
How do you build all of this? You create this conundrum where it's like, well, fuck, it's a comedy, and now we're really scared that Jack Warren's going to die. How do we totally not bum the audience out? Because, you know, he's got to be dead so he can go into the pit, you know, and turning it into that weird sequence somehow just diffuses that tension, and all of a sudden we march on with our insane movie, and it
owns the moment too. Like, the guy is signing on his back as he's being on Kurt Russell's back.
Oh,
as
my
Kurt
God,
Russell's
the
being
best,
clutched.
The best gag in maybe the whole movie is when he takes the money out and he goes, $50, take it.
Jack Warden dying grabs it, clutches it to his chest, and then that's it.
I love that. In itself tells us something about Jack Warden's character. It tells him that perhaps years ago he was more of a huckster like Kurt Russell, but he has come around and he has matured, and now in his old age he has wisdom that he's trying to pass on to Kurt Russell with the driver and cars and all of that, but he still is a huckster at heart, and that's why he grabs that fucking money. And I do
everybody is just it's what you'd expect from them working on a used car lot. And it does not shy away from any of that. And then we move into that sequence.
Real quick, before we kind of missed it, one really important thing I want to touch on, which is, again, to talk about what is Kurt Russell contending with, as opposed to, you know, responsibility, learning his the error of his ways, that sort of thing in this film. No, he seems to be contending with fate, with magical forces, which begins prior to that sequence where, as Jack Warden leaves, it's rumored that he has, again, it's almost like a mythological, long-lost daughter who hasn't been seen in years, who's going to return. And then immediately prior to his death, he gets a call, and he actually says the words over and over again, "It's a miracle. It's a miracle. It's a miracle." Just introducing this element of fate into this situation right prior, which I think also, you know, I don't know, it makes you feel like you're in good hands with his death. Because if he just got fucking murked all of a sudden by this weird dude, but the element of the daughter having called gives you just enough hope that even in this dark moment, there's this little kernel of hope that kind of sustains you through that, which is pretty rad. And again, that begins to be part of this magical world, which is, of course, we have to talk about is personified by Beef. What is Beef's name? I don't care what Beef's name is in this movie.
We're just calling him Beef.
Who believes that red cars are curses and
you know that it took me. I watched the movie twice and I missed the line about the red cars when it came on in the first thing. So when this is all playing out with him being super sisters, I just had missed the setup for that character.
Oh, and the whole commercial thing, the whole commercial with the hood and it's a red car when the lights come on and everything happened,
but I didn't understand what was happening. Right. I just, he doesn't like red cars. I missed the setup that was kind of crucial to all of his big actions throughout the movie.
Again, which is in itself a fun sequence because the introduction then of the daughter, as she comes in, kind of begins to continues to reinforce this red car idea. She showed up in a red car, and of course, so then Jack Warden's daughter arrives, and of course, Kurt Russell immediately has a connection with, because she's like the young, hot, blonde female version of Jack Warden, but she also represents the antithesis of his, you know, honest pragmatism, in that she literally used to work for the consumer protection whatever agency, which is also fun because there's these different things where it's like he not only has to contend with these weird magical forces in the film, but he also has to contend with her. But they even find this weird balance where his lying becomes a kind of superpower that he tries to force on her and her all of her honesty about cars later on. Anyway, so she's introduced and that's rad and that continues things on. But Richard, what happens? What do we like about this movie? Used cars. Get after it.
I think just leading on, like the whole eulogy sequence, I found just stellar. This is just before his daughter comes up. We have this wonderful sequence when he kind of keels over, and then I thought they were going to try to resurrect him by putting him in the car and raising him up in the lightning storm and in the rain, which is so much rain. There is so much rain in that scene, a comical amount of rain. And Kurt Russell is, your headstone's going to be the Fords and the Chevys. And it's just like, what is happening in this fucking movie? All the cinema around it, I was like, they're trying to Frankenstein him to come back to life so his brother doesn't get this lot. So then they bury him in the pit. The daughter's introduced and he's gotta tell her that she's Jack is dead. Is he gonna tell her? Is he going to keep lying to her, but he loves her?
Interesting moment. Well, but specifically, it is the falling in love with her that is that moment where he sort of kind of steps out of his world in kind of a cool way, because you have this guy who's this materialist, who's this pragmatist, which is taken to the Zemeckis we were talking about last time. Everything's taken to 11. So like everything is boobs and explosions and shotguns and cars and money and ambition and all this kind of thing. And he's just completely part of this world and he's tent in that world. And then and it's a great sequence with him at the bar, like what pulls him out of this? And we see even when he goes back to his place, he's very lonely and has messages from a dozen
other women.
Whose number he's lost, you know. So he's, again, has no love, completely spiritually bankrupt. And then he has a connection with a woman because she's the daughter of Jack Warden. But she has a connection with her on this, in this, at this bar. And then she, but the cool thing is, she's the only one who knows that they did this thing, that they buried the dad, that all of this, and she's going to move on anyway. She's over it. She hasn't seen him in 20 years. She, you know, might as well. She thinks he left and went to Florida. She doesn't want to have anything to do with him. All he has to do is let her go, let her walk out of the bar. He can go on being his huckster self and go on and ultimately become a senator and blah, 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 blah. But instead, in that moment, we have that great moment where he's pained that she's leaving, and he goes and he asks her, and he says, well, if and he doesn't even ask her to stay. He's like, if you ever
next time you're in town.
Yeah.
When
all
he's
that
back.
They allow him.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's very conditional. It's like, please go now, but if ever in the future. And just because he does that, she decides to stay. He pays that immediate price for it. And now we see that his heart is no longer, because in the rest of the act now, it's no longer for him about, can we just get through this? Can we make the money? It's instead, how do I break the news to her this time that I buried your dad in a car outside?
There is so much hanging over those scenes with her. Like,
yes,
it's constantly great. this him trying to flirt with her while also trying to skirt around the issue that he buried her father in a car in the pit in the back of the used car lot.
And I dig that. It's cool. And I also like that it doesn't go on, they don't sustain it for too long. It goes on as long as it needs to. And then she finds out via whatever, and then, you know, we move on, et cetera. But yeah, what is it? Go ahead, Richard. I've lost my.
Yeah, we haven't really talked about that first commercial. Like, the Jack Warden's dead, and then that the strippers were direct line. Jack Warden is out of the picture. The owner's, quote, out of town, so they can run the place and not get in. There's no consequences. It's boys.
It's literally about the
boys unsupervised.
Yeah, the boys taking over.
Exactly. Yeah. So
because
then we get
the parents.
The parents are out of town, right? Exactly, in Miami, and so that's where the strippers come in against the silly carnival thing that they have going on across the street. But one of the other things that Kurt Russell wants to do is he knows the two guys that can hack into a football game video feed and get them free commercial airtime. And because the parents are out of town, it's nobody's fault, and they're not liable for anything they do. So they run to the football game, and they've got some sleazebag holding a camera, lights on top of the van.
Lenny and Swiggy are figuring out how to hack into a thing. So they run into a car and go ahead.
They're in the parking lot. They're pretending they're going to sell this car. They're making the parking lot of the stadium feel like
Long story short, they improvise a commercial. They hack into a thing, and then definitely the big culmination is when the hood on the car pops open and it rips the girl's dress off, and then we get boobs on national television. I don't think there are really any consequent or not on national. At least on local television, or whatever it is.
Well,
but we don't know, which I'm not even sure there are consequences for, really, other
they
than
did say,
it
they
gets
did
lots
say,
of attention.
They also said fuck, which is against the rules. But they're wearing these weird fake glasses. It's the camera is, which actually that was a reshoot. They originally had penis nose glasses that they were wearing, you can see. Yes, Kurt Russell points dicks at the camera in like three shots. You can see him in the reverse holding a pair of glasses with a dick on him.
That's fucking hilarious. That is a great example of taking everything to 11 in this goddamn. It wasn't even googly eye glasses, too subtle.
Right,
googly
exactly.
Eye glasses too subtle for this film. We needed dick noses. And because this whole film is kind of about dick nose, like he is a dick nose, Kurt Russell. He is a personification of dick nose. If dick nose glasses and a person to get into that Jeff Goldblum fly machine, Kurt Russell from this movie would emerge as the hybrid
That beautiful, beautiful costume with that ugly blazer and those bright orange pants. Just
beautiful.
But that brings them a lot of success because they have boobs on TV. They write it off. Everybody comes in. We get my second favorite gag of the movie where Beef has the dog pretend to die under the wheels of a car, which is another one of those. Like,
by the way, let's
God.
Talk about Beef. Let's talk about the amazing stunts that Beef does in this movie. I have to say, like, and I think that's him that jumped. Those are great stunts. I mean, first, great stunts throughout the film. And right, sorry, we'll get back to the dog moment.
Sure.
The dog thing in a moment, but
it's all part of the stunts.
It's all part of the stunts, but honestly, some of the smaller stunts were the ones that kind of grabbed me more. Like there's that bit where evil Jack Warden comes to try and kill Beef and chases him with his car, and he just like tries to run him down. He just jumps up over the hood of the car, like right as the car hits that pole and the pole falls over, and you're like, yeep. It's like, it just requires enough clarity for you to understand that it's actually dangerous what's going on, and you're like, yeep. And just like the jumping out of the car and I Want to Hold Your Hand, which doubles over backwards and you're like, Christ, you know.
His, that there was a stunt that I had to like stop and watch in this one. And it was later in the movie where he's walking backwards into oncoming traffic.
No, that's the next one. Obviously, that's the big
stunt
one.
Is like, yes. What the literal fuck.
And it's like, you clearly, and
I have goosebumps picturing it.
Yes. But kudos to Beef, because that clearly required him to just have faith in a great stunt driver and just literally in a wide, completely wide frame on a desolate road, so you can clearly see he's doing it for real. He stands up, starts walking backwards. We realize he's walking backwards directly into, and it's lined up, so you can see it's right there, directly into a car speeding up behind him, and then the car just at the last second just veers out of the way.
Just barely.
And it's so...
But, and it doesn't use that technique of a long lens to make it look like it's that much closer. The camera's pretty... It's a pretty wide shot.
Like, oh, yeah. You're in the space with it.
Yeah. It's like...
Yeah, you're not like way up the road with the fucking Stand By Me train lens or something
right
in
there.
It is right there.
And yeah, apparently he didn't know that the car was going to be that close.
I just assumed that he was just like went for it.
I didn't watch the thing with the commentary, but I read some stuff on it. And Zemeckis was like, he didn't know how close he was, apparently. And Zemeckis was like, I can't believe we did that. Every time I watch it, my scrotum tightens.
That was the effect it had on me. And speaking of dangerous stunts, though, I mean, his you see, like, in the big car chase at the end, Jack Warden begins to literally like chariot race whip
Ben-Hur style
so clearly there is a great affection for kind of pushing the limits on some of these stunts and everything, and because that car barely misses him, and then that's in the goddamn movie, and it was a great moment.
Oh my gosh, yes. Like every time I see that now, it's like, they talk about boys. It's like pure boy. Like, yeah, it'll work. Yeah, it'll work. No one's going to get hurt.
That's what's interesting. It has a boys playing by the train tracks feel to it. And not just in, because you could say that also about, you know, the approach to filmmaking that, again, we're going to talk about a lot on this podcast. But it mean even in subject matter, it has a boys playing around on the railroad tracks sort of a feel. I mean, obviously with the literal parent figure in Jack Warden leaving, and then it's like, oh, the boys have taken over the house for the while he's in Miami.
I mean, talking about boys on the train tracks, he literally jumps over the train, which is something.
Which is so interesting, because when you have a movie, and I had this appreciation for it in this moment. This moment right now. I had appreciation for it in that moment you're referring to when he jumped over the train, of when a film has had many good stunts so far, including stunt like this, that him jumping up, like Beef jumping up over the hood of the car. I mean, obviously all the car stunts throughout, and that moment there where the car veers out of the way, like when he's trying to jump over the car, or he's trying to jump over the train, like when you see the train coming and you know that he's about to start the car, there is a palpable excitement that is building within me, because I know that he's not going to just like barely miss it in a series of six cuts. Like, I know now the film has taught me that there is
that's
a great
how
stunt to
you
expect.
Do it.
Exactly. And the cool thing is, and this is what I loved about that moment is he knows now that you're expecting that. And so he adds in one more quick reversal to, all right, so I know it's going to be a close train miss. That's what I'm going to see, like a really close train miss. And then the train beats him.
You get the fishtail.
He backs up, and there's of course the fucking classic cartoony tow truck there with the ramp on it. and he's
just
goes
pulling levers, it works, and then
and you get a stunt that clearly shatters the car in half upon landing, which is rad. But then he just keeps driving it.
It just breaks. It's wide enough that you can see it like nosedive into the road,
a fucking train, and shatter. And just cuts to Beef inside, and he goes, "Woo!"
I made a note of that. I think it's that laugh. He has that laugh that sounds exactly like the weasel in Roger Rabbit. It's like, hee-hee-hee-hee. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. It's like, is he the weasel in Roger?
He's not. I looked it up because I thought for sure. I was like, that sound is like burned into my brain, that weasel laugh.
Yes, Bob Zemeckis certainly does like people with weird cartoony voices, as we have found out. We got our Eddie Deasons and our others. Anyway, continue, Richard.
I mean, it just, even before all of this like beef with the car and all of his great stunts, like there's a moment where like they show up at the car lot, the older, shittier used car lot, where they sell them all the cars for the students to drive, where you're like, wait a second, this movie is about do what now? And it's like, it is this wonderful escalation where they start Mad Maxing these like a hundred cars, it looks like, just pouring across the desert, the flat desert with the monuments in the background. And there are just a bunch of cars. There's so many cars.
Yeah, so many cars.
Before
we dive squarely into the ending, I think we should address, at least because we touched on it before, but I really feel like it needs more context, because it was a great reversal for me. Because it's like, once you had this fantastic commercial in the beginning, there was just insane over the top sequence. How do you top that? You know, how do you top that in the middle of the movie? And the entire middle of the film turns around that thing where they collaborate with Lenny and Squiggy, who are going to hack, you know, Carter's address, while at the same time Kurt Russell is on a date with Jack Warden's daughter, blonde, used to work for
Consumer Protection Agency,
yada yada yada, who represents, you know, if she knows anything about their shenanigans and goings on, especially the fact that they, you know, buried her dad, that date being played against them hacking the presidential address, to then, and then what do you do? Like, the second commercial is inarguably more intense and extreme in its approach and in my reaction than the first one, and yet, like, I didn't think you could top the first one. And then he shows up, Beef shows up in a cowboy hat, mustache, holding a shotgun.
Yes, sir.
And then we don't quite, and I just watched it for the first time, so I can't remember if we're aware at that moment whether or not he's not in front of their lot and their cars, but he's in front, that he's basically gone over to, because he basically starts shooting up all the cars, and then we realize he's at evil Jack Warden's lot. And anyway, continue, Richard.
Well, I mean, it jumps the second one jumps that commercial because they introduce danger into it. Like, it's, the first one's just like this silly thing, and at this point in the movie they have tried all the things that they're going to try as boys. They're in over their heads, so what's the next thing? It's the boys go too far and take the shotgun with live rounds in it, just like we talked about before, blowing windows out, which is just crazy, blowing the windows out, and then shooting Grimace on High Prices, where even the boy in charge of shooting everything has to turn to camera and be like, Jesus, symbolizing how deep in over their heads they are. Of course, to throw it up to 11 again, there's the prices are too fucking high. And then they dynamite the $24,000 car.
God. It's like talk about an effective use of performance and the effective use of just an F-bomb, because somehow after he's like, we're blowing the holy shit out of prices
high prices
and like shooting cars, when he says the car is like the car, and then he shoots this, and then at the end is that price is too fucking high.
Bam.
And then he blows up the car, and you're just, you know, it's that kind of thing where, and it's a weird thing to say when you hear stories about, and it was one of those stories that, as a, you know, they always wonder about, like, man, he shot for a month with Eric Stoltz on Back to the Future and then cast him. And you're like, that's an insane thing to do. And then you watch these movies and you realize, like, oh, shit, Like, he needs a specific type of actor who is capable of delivering a high level of energy. And I think that is why, perhaps, either you see so many television faces in there, is he wants that big, high, maybe he needs that energy output, which, and again, he shoots Back to the Future for a month or whatever with Eric Stoltz. It doesn't work out for whatever reason, whatever. And then who does he get? He gets Marty McFly, but he gets, you know, a television actor. He gets, you know, so, I mean, and you know, he gets Michael J. Fox, who is coming from television, who can deliver this level of energy and big eyes and cartoony facial expressions and can be the Chuck Jones character, who can be the Tex Avery character he needs him to be.
And also, and grounded, so, and also grounded as a very solid performer, so all the dramatic stuff works. And it's so funny to
like now even look at, we're kind of getting off topic a little bit, but I'll just go into this digress. Like, yeah, it makes so much more sense to then get into a moment in Back to the Future where, like, a kid has gone back into the 50s and his mom thinks he's hot and is hitting on him. And then, like, all of that, in fact, seems very tame by comparison to this film. And yet, completely of a piece with the style of regardless of how completely different this film is from a film like Back to the Future, it feels so much of a piece with that style of film, and yet so much more tame than anything that's in this movie.
It's the same boys in the back of the classroom whispering jokes to each other. It's the same sort of thing. What if you went back in time and your mom fell in love with you?
Yes, and it's another thing where it feels just like I Want to Hold Your Hand. It feels oddly out of time, you know, because it's like we knew the leaning a little bit more into the kind of magical and familial and heartfelt aspects of this a couple films later with Back to the Future, and even before that with Romancing the Stone, obviously was a big fucking, you know, really worked. And yet this style, I couldn't help but while watching it and thinking, this feels very 90s to me. Like, this film, I feel like, which came out, you know, it almost again feels like a kind of thing that's 10 years, 12 years, whatever, ahead of when people wanted to see, you know, R-rated Tex Avery type shit, you know? And so again, it's this interesting thing, especially for a guy whose biggest success is going to be a time travel movie a few years later. It just, again, it feels like a film that's of a time, just not the right one, not the right time that it was in. You know, used cars needed to get into a time machine travel to the mid 90s, and it would have been a hit.
It may have been a hit. Like, I read some about the release in this, and this, a lot like I Want to Hold Your Hand, has it, it plays really well for the preview audience. Like, it had the highest ratings of any test screening in Columbia Pictures history at the time. Like, it tested really well. So well, in fact, that they pulled the release a month earlier and didn't do advanced marketing for it, and dropped it in week two of Airplane. So it was just a failure of marketing. Yep. But by all, apparently, based on the test screenings or the test screening, it was something that people wanted, mm-hmm. and actually found a life on cable television as a cult thing that people would just tune into. So
it's so interesting, though, because it's interesting to say that it came out during Airplane, because now everything I was saying feels different when you think about, oh, Airplane also came out, and talk about a film
also made by boys,
also with full of boy humor, and also in a way I would say more effective synthesis of a kind of cartoony sensibility with the moving picture and real people. And God, that must have added extra sting to it in the moment to not only have your high testing film moved and flop, but flop against someone else who really is kind of trying to do the same thing, and it becomes immediately like this big hit, this cultural touchstone, etc. That's interesting to think about them coming out at the same time. One of them not making money, and one of them making a lot of money.
Yes. And I think it was just, so it feels like it's same thing with I Want to Hold Your Hand. It's like, and he says something to this effect on those stories, which is, he didn't realize that making the movie was only half of the thing. You have to continually fight for the thing to get it released properly, and win the edit, and win the release, and the marketing dollars, because that movie had a very similar, like, the exact same fate. It tested well, they dropped it without marketing, and all of a sudden it goes off critically well. Like, this movie didn't the critics liked it. Everybody thought it was funny. It was the second funniest movie to Airplane that summer.
Yeah. Interesting. That's an interesting, like, if it a different trajectory potentially for the whole career, if it had just come out a few weeks earlier, had time to take hold prior to that. I'm not saying it would have usurped Airplane's success. I think Airplane was kind of undeniable, but still, it's an interesting.
But what happens to? I mean, just I don't know what the answer to this is, but it's an entirely different career Zemeckis has if this used cars succeeds.
Yes. He's not thinking about how do I now recontextualize these things in a different package that's maybe not so R-rated, that's maybe more this or that. You know, he's not questioning himself. Instead, we maybe get 20 more years of this kind of R-rated Jackass stuff, you know.
And can you imagine?
Then do we end up at Polar Express, or do we end up in some completely other place? I don't know.
It's somewhere else entirely, I think.
Well, think about the fact that, you know, what is this, comes out in like 80, right? 79, mm-hmm. 80 or something. 80. You know, he's only 10 years away, I think, from like that sensibility kind of reigning, 15, whatever, from that sensibility kind of reigning supreme.
Yeah, 92.
And so, which also makes sense because he made some insane shit in the 90s too. So, but it's interesting to see if this boys being boys sensibility had to kind of, with all of this, you know, just the antics and the pranks and all that kind of shit, that had just soldiered on for like two or three more movies and then suddenly arrived in the 90s.
Well,
what kind of movies would he have been making?
I'm curious, like, because I'll admit to this right now, I haven't seen Death Becomes Her. That's one of the reasons I'm excited to do this. But in my head, like, that is an example of like this version of Zemeckis. I can't speak to that. I haven't
there,
seen it.
Well, but yes, you are 100% right in that there are some very, very, very Looney Tunes, DC Comics and very, very, there's a lot of shit going on in Death Becomes Her. We'll get to that in a minute. But
I'm excited.
And that's your big blind spot, which we will get to. We need to find a good guest. We'll figure that out. If you have any ideas for guests for Death Becomes Her, who knows the most about it, let us know. Sound off. Reach out to Richard on Instagram. And
at Bob Zemeckis. That's right.
At Bob Zemeckis. We haven't talked about it yet. You now are at Bob Zemeckis on Instagram. So at Bob Zemeckis on Instagram. Let him know who you think the guest should be for Death Becomes Her.
That's not Bob Zemeckis. That's me.
Yes, exactly. Let him know. You get it. So anyway, we're talking about the insane commercial, which is now really a sequence that has burned into my retinas forever. The middle commercial, and that precipitates a cascade of events where they get reported, and then they move the thing, and Jack Warden shows up, and there's that rad stunt where he tries to hit Beef with the car, and he finds the body, and then the girl finds out that the guy's dead, and the whole thing, it all unravels and stuff, and then all of a sudden we're in endgame territory with this goddamn thing.
Yeah. There's one thing I want to talk about before. I want to talk about how we get into Endgame, because with our history editing a lot of stuff and you managing editors, mm-hmm. the wonderful thing that gets us into this Endgame is
I edited for a long time before I was an editor. I'm like an Uber editor, a super editor, if you will.
Exactly. You know? You don't even have to touch the software anymore.
I am the Hydra. I am many. I had like 8 or 9 editors working for me back then. So yeah, I really was like the Hydra. And whenever one of them would get cut down, another one would be
two would pop up.
Yes, exactly. I'm the Snake Richard.
But it's such a silly editorial joke. Where at the news studio, Jack Warden's daughter releases a commercial where she stumbles over a word, and the editor in the TV studio takes the word miles out of one section and dubs it over her saying style. So she says, mm-hmm. come down to see our miles of cars. And it's the sloppiest edit. And Jack Warden in that scene is like, that's great. Oh my God, it's so real. And obviously it's a terrible edit. And that's the thing. It was like, that's the clearest case of false advertising. Yes. And they go into the court. And it's like, I have experts that are saying this is, there's been nothing touched up with this. And just the thought that stupid audio edit is the what gets us into this end game is something I find so funny.
More cast, and then more great. It's just talking about more of the great cast, which we've barely touched on. Like Joe Flaherty plays some sort of official who's there, who
the deputy to the, yeah, the mayor or something.
Yeah, who's he's who, you know, is some sort of functionary who's trying to as a mallet to smash him. And so. Basically, in this melodrama that's playing out, the blonde maiden is now going to have her house taken away by the city, because of course it is revealed that the real reason that evil Jack Warden wants his brother dead and wants ownership now and wants to challenge the claim of the daughter is because he wants to build the big freeway, the big road. I mean, it's literally very like this. That's why. Again, I was thinking a lot about The Great Race. Mm-hmm. I was thinking a lot about Blake Edwards, which, you know, you think about when you think about Bob Zemeckis, but holy shit, after watching I Want to Hold Your Hand and this film, I'm thinking about that a lot. Because the connection had always been, you know, because like, what's his name? Richard Williams, who did the animation for Roger Rabbit, did like Pink Panther, Return of Pink Panther opening sequence, and some of the really cool Pink Panther animated sequences. So there's a direct connection there. And yet it was like when watching this like a melodrama with all these cars, and again having just actually at the New Beverly just a couple of months ago seen a month ago one of the last movies I saw before the quarantine set in was The Great Race. I was thinking quite a bit about that, and it's just this, you have the blonde maiden, she's getting her house taken away, he has to now come in and figure out a way to save her, because they will take away her house if in fact she does not have a literal mile of cars, which means 250 cars. So he goes to the bad guy from Three Miguel. Amigos,
El Guapo.
He goes to El Guapo. El Guapo sells him a plethora of cars. El Guapo sells him a plethora of cars, and then to atone, to symbolize that he has now come full circle, and now he is at least within him, it has not taken over the whole of him, but he has that Jack Warden goodness, that Dudley Do-Right goodness in him. He finds a way to, while still serving his own interests at the time, a kind of atone, because he gave only shitty cars to the driving school at the beginning, which was this act of charity that the Jack Warden, grandfatherly Jack Warden, wanted him to do. At some point, when he's at his low point, the driving school teacher complains that all the cars have broken down, and so he now brings in an armies of 16-year-olds
in 15-year-olds without
where we get some fantastic cameos. Both of the McFly siblings, who are both in I Want to Hold Your Hand, show up. Richard, tell me about them.
One of them is hyper nervous, Wendy Jo Sperber, who played the Beatles superfan.
And it was really cool to see those cameos.
Oh, totally. And to know that they come back, and the El Guapo's in Romancing the Stone, so it's nice to see him working with the same people.
Oh, yeah,
but she's like, oh, my hands are at 10 and 2, I'm ready to go. And then he tells her to start the car, and she's like, oh, I'd have to take my hands off at 10 and 2, is that okay? And the guy's like, take your hands off, start the car, please.
And then I think Jimmy Olsen plays like some burnout. So like Linda McFly is the nervous driver, and Jimmy Olsen is like a burnout. And it's interesting to see him hang on to those people now through not just them, where we mentioned, oh, they're in I Want to Hold Your Hand. Cool, you know.
But they're great. And they're great in that movie, and that movie is great. I mean, everybody should watch
it. She is a force of nature in that movie. She is that whole movie. And then he is rad in that movie as well. And then it's nice to see them now showing up. And it's like, oh, I would say good luck charms, but neither of the films did particularly. But he brought them all the way to the promised land, salvation.
The third time's the charm for them.
Yeah. She was on Bosom Buddies, apparently. I never watched Bosom Buddies.
Me
because
neither.
To have watched it.
She had a career on television.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Big old career, which makes sense.
Yeah, and so we have all these children driving all these cars, and they have to go across the desert, and it becomes
Mad Max Fury Road.
Exactly. Like even before Road Warrior, we get
convoy.
Sequence. Mad Max had like just come out, so it wasn't even a reference point. You have, you know, dozens of cars being driven, kicking up dust across the desert, and then you have. What's crazy to me is Jack Warden's on the back of a truck in the middle of the desert acting as the vehicles are moving. Like,
yes.
That's crazy. Yeah. That's crazy. And he's like chaining them. And you have some really wonderful, it's not just you have like a basically a kind of a recreation. Feels like the general. Buster Keaton's the general when Kurt Russell gets thrown from the truck and has to Mad Max Fury Road back to his car. So he's like leaping from car to car, and it's shot like impeccable, like crazy awesome stunt work of a guy jumping from car to car to get back.
And by the way, let's talk about by the way, Zemeckis's formalism and his frame, because I'm beginning to see, you can almost begin to see the picture of why a guy would now want to move into later on CGI environments and that sort of thing, just because, like, there's one shot in particular. There's a lot of good shots, but there's one shot in particular where, you know, it begins on the chief from Last Action Hero as the mechanic coming out from under. He stands up into a two shot with Kurt Russell in a big wide garage. Then Beef pulls in a white car and the
with
back
a girl.
Runs in. It becomes a three shot, but then the
girl is still in
the passenger seat. Yeah, exactly. So we have this interesting foreshot. She even moves over into the passenger seat to just sort of perfectly be in this foreshot. Then we get a couple of those great, you know how I like a lot of heads in the frame.
That's heads in the frame are the best. And, but you get that in Zemeckis' stuff. He's always those, pulled back.
You get two little shot reverse shot with the three heads in the frame. But anyway, as he comes in, the fact that the car hits its mark, she's there, they pop into the thing. It's this interesting thing where you can see how important it is for him and for, I'm not going to just say the two Beef to have a well-composed frame. I mean that you can see that his interest in animation, his interest in comedy, his interest in Blake. Well, it's not just the
in
timing,
precision.
His interest in timing.
Yeah.
Let me finish, goddammit.
Yeah, I'm going to keep
You can
talking.
See that his interest is in, that he likes generating all these gags from within the frame, that he likes using every part of the frame to generate these gags, people popping in. But as a result, he has this very kind of meticulous and composed frame the whole time that I imagine is somewhat exhausting to have to constantly execute. Then suddenly you move into a world where all of these interesting animation style gags can be more easily rendered, because you can still work with actors and get performances, but it's all in a giant fantasy land of CGI and pixels. You can begin to see like the amount of effort that he's putting into all of that timing and all of that framing to try and achieve this kind of cartoon style of this cartoon aesthetic. You know, with real people, real cameras, putting Jack Warden on the back of a car while driving across
it
a
looks
goddamn
awesome.
Desert. It looks
That's
awesome.
Not green screen. Not green screen.
Yeah, but you can see why, as someone gets older, he would, if in order to achieve that aesthetic, he can't break. He's not the kind of director who's going to break down into like small chamber pieces where you have heads shot on long lenses and there's a bunch of dialogue. I mean. It's a young man's game being on the back of that car driving across that desert is what I'm trying to say. So if he wants to keep doing that, but with a crazy goddamn fucking ice train or something like that, he's like, I'm going to make Tom
sense.
Hanks all CGI.
I don't know if
it makes sense, but I'm starting to understand.
No. I think it does make, you see a lot, all of the gags are so precision based. Like the thing has to hit the mark. This mark has to hit. The timing has to be this, and that happens so often in like you can see it starting to happen in I Want to Hold Your Hand. It's definitely happening in this. It's happening. I'm sure we'll see it countless other times in the future. But that precision requires so much effort, and it's not like he's getting forever to shoot these things. This was shot in 28 days.
Yeah.
And 28 days for the amount of precision and stunt work. In this is kind of mind-boggling for me.
The other thing is you see, though, the counterpoint to that is, you know, you see lots of other filmmakers. I mean, Spielberg certainly uses a camera that's that playful and crazy, but continues to do it in live action, but he is sustained by the gigantic engine Spielbergianness and doesn't seem to have the direct preoccupation with those kind of technologies in the way he does. But I don't know, man, like I just, but that's the interesting thing is that that's what makes it especially interesting that the character is content. The film is not in any sense atheistic. You know, it's like with someone who's so obsessed with that level of precision, and then later on in his life with all of these technologies and everything, the film is, you know, the Kurt Russell character, he has to contend with literal magic. Like, of course, a big turn that happens near the end is that. His temptation, again, in the same way that he could let her walk out of that bar and get away with everything scot-free, he doesn't crawl out of a hole to ultimately come back at the end and to ultimately come back at the end and save the day. Instead, it's quite the opposite. He puts everything on a football game. He begins to utilize Beef's bad luck as a superpower, betting against the team that Beef is sure is going to win. And then Beef, in order to help him, he puts all the money he has on it. And then Beef, in order to help him, literally uses his bad luck, uses magic, which they make very explicit works in the movie. Like, yes. They knock over a salt shaker, and in knocking
he's
over a salt
dumping
shaker,
all of them, salt shakers all over everybody, diving over the bar to crawl under a ladder.
And that's the thing, but that's the interesting thing, is that it has that childlike logic to it. And it's, again, you can look at it and say, well, this is fucking dumb, but then you see how it's actually nested in the dilemma that Kurt Russell is having to deal with. Like, he has no spiritual values, no love, no faith, no anything that Jack Warden has. Now that Jack Warden's out of the picture, he has to fight for it himself. And that's where it gets interesting, where you see that, oh, like, he is portraying, like, the world of magic, the aesthetic texture he gives it is that of just boys playing in this imaginary cartoon world. So where literally you can make a football game go the other way by dumping out salt shakers and then ultimately grabbing a thing and smashing the big mirror over the bar. And then we see that every character eventually has to find some balance with this. You have Beef, who ultimately has to get over his fear of driving a red car in order to jump over the thing, which again seems arbitrary, but is, I think, very well integrated to Beef's worldview and how Beef operates as the kind of spiritual accessory to
Kurt Russell's pragmatism
side of it. Yeah, exactly. And then at the same time, and the film also, just to kind of skip to the end a little bit for a second, even does that with Jack Warden's daughter. In that she is Miss, you know, Goody Two Shoes. She worked for the Consumer Protection Agency to talk about like the mellow aspects of this film, and yet she, in the end, has to learn a compromise with Kurt Russell's hucksterness. Like, her final choice in the film is to lie a little bit, and that
it's yellow primer.
It's the yellow primer line. It's interesting that every character kind of, and that there's a great unity that's created at the end, where every character kind of takes on a little bit of takes on a little bit of themselves, and they sort of all congeal at the end. It's really kind of cool. I dig it.
It's the happy ending that you're so fond of. We have a movie about liars and thieves and corrupt politicians and corrupt dealings, and we get the wonderful everybody's come together. Everybody's come together. They're a big happy family. Everything's going well now on the used car lot that they own.
Yeah. So everyone lives in a big house together. The Beetlejuice ending, right? I love so much. But we kind of got away from it there for a second. So he smashed thing, and then Kurt Russell actually wins. He puts all the money. He uncut gems the situation. He puts all the money onto the team. His $40,000. He wins. The next time we see him, he's wearing a snazzy suit, and he's getting in the back of a limo with the corrupt politician guy who he needs to the $50,000 or more to pay
the
his
down
way
payment
in
to on the, as on a
down payment
campaign.
To be a senator or whatever. It doesn't fucking matter.
Where he can split half of his grift.
Yes, exactly. And so then he finally learns the terrible truth that we all saw or could see coming, that
her
he
goodness
did not,
is,
which is
her goodness, which is, cannot save the car lot.
Well,
she's going to
yes,
lose.
He sees her, that. He's yeah. Well, no, he sees that. He sees the fact that her car lot is closed because of the other thing. But instead, in fact, he sees that his first task as senator is going to be to announce the very same road that evil Jack Warden is going to use to pave over Miss Polly Prissy Pants's car lot. And in finding that, he realizes that the pragmatist he has been striving to be this whole time is the evil Jack Warden, and that basically the cost, you know, by trying to maintain his world of money and ambition, the cost of trying to maintain that while still courting spiritual values will be like the decimation of her and the decimation of the memory of Jack Warden and all of those things, and he will become evil Jack Warden. And so what does he do? He immediately rejects all of those things, and he uses the money to go to El Guapo and buy
a plethora of cars.
And all of that, which is rad. And then you have the awesome fucking chase sequence and all that kind of stuff. And then, yeah, I dig it that everyone kind of congeals, because it's a meaningful happy ending in the sense that we see the extremes of the film, the many, many, many extremes of the film, including Kurt Russell's just insane hedonism at the beginning, all eventually reconciled back to kind of unity at the end, where we can see that everyone's kind of just keeping everyone else in check, and that's where we arrive, and that's why it kind of feels like they gel as a family there at the end. So I dig it, man. And of course, they all end up owning the car lot together and living, etc.
And then there's a TV show where their hijinks are present, which was almost a thing.
Yes. No, really?
Yeah, they made a pilot. Bob Gale produced a pilot. Didn't go to series.
With the original cast?
No.
Oh, damn. That would be rad.
Almost a series. Yeah.
Now's the time, Richard, to return Netflix.
Used cars. Yeah.
Yes, Kurt Russell and Joe Flaherty still around.
Is Beef still around? Beef?
Oh, you know, that's a good question. I assume he is. He's not that old, so I just assume he's around. And then who else is in this movie? Michael McKean, he's still around. He's on Better Call Saul, right? I haven't watched that show, but...
Me neither.
Yeah, but he's on that.
He's still, I guess,
Still kicking. Yeah, we'll find out, man.
Well, I guess we got to get on that, on writing that series.
There you go.
The one thing we didn't talk about that I do want to talk about is that fucking dog. I love that dog.
Yes.
All of the driving over the car stunt is so, stunt is so great. That dog crawling so cutely under the car. Mm-hmm. And then
great evidence right there. The dog of my specific point about 15 years later or whatever, 10, 15 years later, all that dog stuff, you know, in this film, that's a little, whatever it is. And then a few years later, and I'm just going to pretend that these are the only two films that do this because it makes my example work, but I'm going to do this. A few years later, what do we see? Jim Carrey in the mask with that Jack Russell Terrier executing a lot of similar gags. And that's what I'm saying, is that R-rated mixing with a cartoon, with a fun dog, all the cartoon shit that's in the mask. It's another example of the film. Again, you take used cars, you put it in the early 90s, and it's rad.
It becomes the mask.
It becomes a big hit. You know?
Yeah.
And becomes what?
Yeah, it becomes the mask. Yeah. And Wishbone was a big thing. That Jack Russell Wishbone storytelling show. I watched
It's a beagle,
much. That dog, it just, when he lifts him up, is just completely lifeless. His tongue's hanging out. They gave the dog a sedative. They gave
perfect. That was going to be my question. Is like, there is no way that isn't alive. Dogs don't know that hard what's going on.
Right. So gave the dog a sedative. It's just, you can tell they had to put a shot of the dog like picking his head up. It's just an edit that's thrown in there. It'd be like, the dog's not dead. We tried to set this up. You didn't get it. The dog's not dead.
Turns out when you sedate a dog, it's a very death-like sleep.
Oh my God. That's
especially
one of those lines.
The guy screaming and crying like, this dog is dead.
And you're saying a very dead-looking dog. Oh my gosh. And just talking about socially irresponsible stuff like that was one of the things I wrote, that it's so specific. And it almost feels like a studio note. Guys, you have to show the dog look up so we know the dog is not dead. But the dog is wonderful. The barks. Toby wants to go on a test drive and him peeing on the dude's goggles.
I feel, again, profoundly naive. I feel profoundly naive having not seen this, venturing into this podcast, in that it's like so much so like scenes now I realize where Marty McFly's mom is hitting on him and stuff like that. It's like, you think like, why is that? It's like, you realize now, I guess, like, that's the reason Bob Zemeckis made that movie.
Yes, 100%.
Just for that devilish hijinks of that's why. The rest of that shit was just there so that he could have that weird perverse shit happening, and I dig that, man. I dig that.
And this is, I'm excited, I'm getting increasingly excited about watching Forrest Gump with this lens. I think it's going to be a different viewing experience with used cars behind us.
you are 100% right, because A, you know, his the very direct relationship with animation and with all that kind of stuff makes it adds an interesting perspective to what's going to come much, much later down the line. And I just think understanding where his kind of unfiltered what his unfiltered sensibilities kind of look like makes me very, very eager to now see evidence of those, to re-examine Forrest Gump again and see those sensibilities showing up, because already I can kind of see them, but I don't want to think about it. I don't want to think about it right now.
I'm trying really hard not to think about it, but I think and even watching Back to the Future now is going to be a different experience.
That's the reason I keep referencing Back to the Future, is because it's so early in the filmography. I fear we're going to be talking about it soon enough anyway. But yeah, it's all, and it's so proximate in his filmography to this, and sharing cast and et cetera. It's hard to not talk about it. But yeah, I'm very, very much trying not to think very hard about Forrest Gump or Roger Rabbit or any of those things right now, so that I can see them with new eyes. The eyes, through the eyes of a Robert Zemeckis, through the eyes of a Kyle who has now knows that Robert Zemeckis has made I Want to Hold Your Hand and Used Cars. And I think I have a much better idea of who he is.
he's a weirdo. Big weirdo, which I love. And I think it's interesting that, like, you have I Want to Hold Your Hand flops, you have this flop, and then the year before this you have 1941, which they wrote for Spielberg, also flops, right? And and Zemeckis is said on this commentary, he's glad he loves this movie Used Cars still, but he's glad he got it out of his system. And it almost feels like Hollywood whipped some of this out of him. Not through any active whipping, but just through the flops, the nature of the flops, or feeling like these things were flops.
Yeah. And I was just thinking, like, this, you know, it's interesting to think about the nature, like just the nature of the juxtaposition between, like, this sensibility and the cartoony Chuck Jonesy, Tex Avery type stuff, because it certainly feels also of a piece with just the raunchy raunchy boys will be boys comedies, which kind of existed a lot in the 70s. And I mean, the 80s was rife with that kind of shit. So again, it feels odd. It feels strange with it coming at right at the junction between those two decades, doing well presumably and all of that. It just feels like a thing strangely, again, out of time with itself. But Richard, so what are our takeaways here, Richard? Don't you tell us what our takeaways here? What are we doing?
This Used Cars is a wonderful lens into the unfiltered Robert Zemeckis. That's the big thing. And there we see a lot of precision, a lot of stunts. I didn't expect to see so many stunts in his early filmography. Like, I never appreciated stunts as was a thing that Zemeckis should be known for.
But then, just to touch on that for a second, you see all of these moments that, I think the entire reason we got into this podcast was this discussion of you talking about thinking that Back to the Future was a perfect movie, and some slightly hipper than now folks who are close friends of yours, but some people who were being a bit hipper than now and saying, really, you think so? Bob Zemeckis, not Bob Zemeckis, but Back to the Future, had not, you know. And now part of the reason we say that is we see all of these delightful moments so well executed over and over and over again, it almost seems supernatural in Back to the Future. You see, like, you know, Biff stands up at the counter and Marty's eyes go up.
Oh, and you have that moment in here. Like,
that
moment 100%. Is in Used Cars.
Yeah, and you see, and we talked about how you see various other his other gags in this as well. And but you also see all these incredible stunts. And so when you get to the action-y moments in Back to the Future, the point I'm trying to make here is you see how many reps he got to be able to, by making these films, and even though they didn't connect, he's building this very, very, very robust skill set with these films for stunts and timing and, you know, and physical comedy and all of this shit. So when he arrives, you know, with Romancing the Stone, and when he arrives with Back to the Future from Zeus's head fully clad in armor, it's because, you know, he is like, God damn, there's a lot of effort in the movie. So much effort.
Yeah. And I think Romancing the Stone, I think we're going to see something slightly different, where he's kind of adapting sensibilities for Hollywood, because Romancing the Stone, he had to have hit at this point. So, and I think that's what I want to track, is where are we getting the this kind of civilization, mm-hmm. the civilized Zemeckis come in, where he's raising the floor,
the taming of Zemeckis,
and then where are these big, big silly Tex Avery, Chuck Jones, Looney Tunes moments coming in? And I think that's going to be the thing that we're going to start seeing, is the kind of civilization, the taming mm-hmm. of Robert Zemeckis, where he's kind of we're losing bits of this unfiltered stuff, but you still have these peaks where you have the silly Chuck Jones mm-hmm. Looney Tunes stuff sneaking into all of his later films, and also I'm curious to see like how the stunt thing kind of develops, because I'd never thought uh-huh. of him as a stunt guy, and if yeah, these yeah. first two films are any indication, and knowing Romancing the Stone is next, like mm-hmm. that's interesting. But I think on the whole, looking at what a Zemeckis film looks like, and like that's one of the things I was interested in. It's very wide, a lot of wide yes. lenses, a lot of heads in frames, a lot yes. of really long masters.
More and more of that was more of that was definitely welcome and definitely fun. But the other thing, and I guess this is what we're kind of you see other things starting to emerge that are very Zemeckisian. Like again,
Zemeckis.
Both the characters, even though Kurt Russell has to give up this money he's won to save the used car thing, he ultimately inherits the lot, he inherits the house, he does all of that. What's her name? Sally Meatballs gives up her shot at the Beatles to keep Jimmy Olsen, or photos of the Beatles to keep Jimmy Olsen happy, but then ultimately gets the pictures with the Beatles, and presumably it boosts her career, etc. And so, you know, Nancy Allen gets fucked by Paul McCartney's music in that movie. And so it's this interesting, great synergy where, like, he doesn't completely learn the error of his ways, you know, or any of that. It's this great balancing and this interesting unity that happens you can begin to see the kind of moral universe of Bob Zemeckis is very important. What if a character is a huckster? It means something, and it's going to mean something to every beat that follows, and it's going to mean something about how the ending of the movie works. And again, these are just it's interesting because I don't know. It's kind of cool because I'm trying to still kind of figure it out. This magic in this ordered world that exists in all of Bob Zemeckis. I don't know. I'm digging it. Continue, Richard. Go.
And I think it's going to be interesting to see once we get out of, like, he didn't write Romancing the Stone, and he didn't. I don't know that he wrote. We're getting to the back. Once we get into later in his filmography, we don't have him existing as a writer. So what does it mean, looking at these movies, Zemeckis as a director, as opposed to just the writer, because obviously mm-hmm. Used Cars, I Want to Hold Your Hand, Back to the Future 1, 2, 3 are all hyper intricate, very complicated screenplays that have a mm-hmm. lot of moving parts and a lot of things yes. Moving back and forth that are yeah. brought up and returned, and even with like mm-hmm. the red car thing is yeah. very Back to the Future in its execution. Like you have the setup, then you have the reminder, then you have the second thing yeah. and then you have the
well everything has well everything has both a literal logic and it has this great emotional logic too, you know, in the sense that, you know, you can pretty much account for everyone's arc pretty clearly, and it's pretty easy to just sort of describe it here and the various turns the characters go through, and that's what I dig in general about it. But I don't know, have we said everything there is to say about Used Cars at this point? I feel like I'm kind of talked out.
I think the last thing to say is this movie, even though it was a flop, this movie is what got him on to Romancing the Stone. So yeah. like there is some justice in the universe. Michael Douglas saw Used Cars and was like, Zemeckis is the guy, which mm-hmm. I had heard but hadn't seen Used Cars. And after watching mm-hmm. the last sequence, it's like, yes, okay, it makes sense why yep. someone who had a movie that needed an action director would come calling at Zemeckis mm-hmm. to do a thing. So I think that's the right. last interesting point, which leads us into the next movie, which is Romancing the Stone.
Which I have not seen in a good long while. I saw it. It's one of those things that was kind of ubiquitous on cable when we were kids. It was always on, you know, so it's like I feel like I know it pretty well. But at the same time, it has been a good long, long, long while since I've seen it. So I'm very curious to kind of dive in there, and especially dive in now into some slightly more familiar Zemeckis territory, just because now I feel like I really, the hope when in getting into this was that there would be an opportunity that we would see it through new eyes. But I think that now, just having watched these two films and enjoyed both of them and kind of been genuinely surprised by both of them, I not just surprised that they were good, but genuinely just surprised, I think, by the nature of the films themselves and what it has very immediately and clearly revealed to me about films that I know very, very well backwards and forwards, like Back to the Future. I definitely am now more excited to go into Romancing the Stone and to go into the rest of his filmography, because I really feel like I have new eyes which to see it.
There's so, going to be so I'm much rad. More to see. So yeah. much more.
Yeah, and more rambling, I'm sure, about this interesting, again, this moral universe of Bob Zemeckis, where people, if you do right, and again, it's a kind of Horatio Alger kind of a morality, but I kind of dig it, where you, if you do right, you are also rewarded in the material world for having done right. And we've seen it kind of building, and we're going to definitely see it in the Back to the Future coming up. But let's continue to discuss that. And if you have any thoughts about that, you should also sound off in the comments below, whatever this is posted on.
Instagram, why not? Yeah, at Bob Zemeckis, that's where the show is at. Kyle, what's your handle?
Oh, yeah, that's right. I am at under Kyle Bogart, MR, Kyle Bogart, on the most sensual Instagram account on the internet.
Beautiful, wonderful. Okay, buttheads, we'll see you. See you on the next
where
one.
Where are you on the internet, Richard?
I'm at Bob Zemeckis.
Oh, that's right, you're at Bob Zemeckis.
It's confusing if I give at Bob Zemeckis and the other one.
You shouldn't you should just do... Yeah. We haven't really... given enough time, I'm sure we will in subsequent episodes, to the fact that you now have at Bob Zemeckis.
What else is there to dissect?
Spelled the usual way, Richard.
Spelled the usual way. B-O-B-S-M-E-K. Oh God, yes. I got it wrong.
If you have any thoughts about how that or anything else should be, let me know. Let us know at Bob Zemeckis.
at Kyle Bogart. That's where we're on the internet.
At Mr. Kyle Bogart, you son of a bitch. I didn't, I'm a mister now. Have you seen my beard?
I'm going to have to cut this part.
leave it in.
At Mr. Kyle Bogart. I didn't know you were a mister now. I didn't know you got married again.
Yes. No, you don't have to be married to be a mister. I'm just a mister.
Oh, that's the
I'm
Mrs.
clearly
thing.
A mister due to the fact that I have a beard, Richard.
I lost mine, so what's that make me?
That makes you a Flanders. We discussed that earlier.
Oh, right. The Flanders thing.
That makes you a Mr. Flanders. A Ned Flanders. You're giving Ned vibe.
I don't know. I don't know, Kyle. Heidely hodely. I haven't thought about Flanders in a long time. Heidely hodely. There you go. I can probably do it. Give me a minute. I'll get it on the next one. All right. Romancing the Stone's next. Let's do this thing.
Romancing the Stone is next. Cool, man. Later, buddy.
Later, buddy.